You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The history of monsters is the history of man. For without man to vilify, fear, and even worship these creatures, they couldn't be monsters. For surely it is we who are the measuring stick by whom monstrosity is measured. But what does it mean when we declare something's a monster? Scott Poole's new book is all about that question, framed in the context of the history of America. Monsters in America, next on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. Today, we've got Karen Stolzno, Ben Radford, and myself, Blake Smith, discussing the history of monsters in America. But first, let me congratulate the winners of our Monster Talk 2012 t-shirt contest. Our first place winner is Rick Stromowski. Second place goes to Chris Barella, and third place goes to Sean Steele. Thanks so much to everyone who submitted an entry. Selecting from the fantastic entries was one of the toughest things we've had to do on this show. We'll be getting shirts ready and set up a place for you to get them very soon. For now, I'd like to try a little experiment this week, if you don't mind. You don't have to participate, but I'm really trying to see what the power of iTunes reviews is for listenership. If you're not driving or doing something which would make taking part in this experiment unsafe, would you mind pausing the show for just a few moments and going to iTunes and giving us a review? It should only take a moment, and what I'd like to see is what happens if we get 1,000 people to suddenly review the show. I think it would be really meaningful. Would you help me find out? Okay, so let's do that now. Are you back? Did you actually give us a review? I'll go read them later. It's time to get going with some
Monster Talk.
Talking with Dr. Scott Poole, an associate professor of history at the College of Charleston, South Carolina. And we're talking to you today about your new book, Monsters in America. So, you're a professor of history.
Right.
But your book's on monsters.
Right.
How'd that happen?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of American historians that have the same kind of reaction. As far as I know, this is really the first book in American history that deals with the idea of the monster. Now, I will say that in other kinds of historiography, in early modern history and in medieval history, this has actually been a pretty big area of focus. It's actually kind of a growth industry in early modern history. But American historians have not explored this area. And sometimes tend to see it as less history, more cultural studies, more sort of studies of pop culture, mass culture, that kind of thing. I'm definitely interested in that stuff, but I think that sort of the story of the monster as part of historical narratives is more complicated than that.
So, Scott, your book tackles a wide range of monsters, and I was wondering, what's your definition of monster?
Well, you know, I actually refused to give a definition of the monster in the book.
I know.
Sort of at the very beginning, I essentially say that to give the monster meaning sort of prevents, a specific meaning, prevents us from thinking about how different historical moments have given us different kinds of historical monsters. I think that part of that comes from my interests to sort of my own scholarly activity as a historian. I mean, historians really tend to not like abstract definitions. Things that can be true, whether you're talking about the 18th century, the 19th century, or the day before yesterday. And so I prefer, just as part of my methodology, to really think about, okay, what does the monster mean in this particular era? What is being defined as monstrous? And there really is, you know, the two parts to that. There's sort of, okay, what's the monster du jour? You know, what's the monster of the moment? But then, what does that mean in that era when someone describes something as a monster? And I think that it's, I think as you look through the book, you see how that really changes, as American society changes over about 300 years.
Yeah, I'd agree. There are lots of different meanings and different ways that the word's used.
In that,
I
was going to say, you don't want to confuse the monster du jour with the monster de Jean, which is the monstard.
The monstard.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, you know, I think, I actually borrow this idea from another scholar, scholar in literary studies, Judith Habersham, who says that that monsters are meaning machines. I guess if I have a baseline definition, if I'm really pressed on it, if I have to have a definition, then I think that's what I would say. They actually are productive of meaning at particular points in history. They also, pull in different kinds of meanings out of the historical context.
Sure.
Well, let me follow up on that, because that's an interesting thing that I've always found about monsters is that, you know, monsters are very contextual in my experience. You know, that what one person or one group thinks of a monster, another group or society may not think of as a monster at all. So, given that you're sort of approaching monsters from a contextual, area in which, you know, we're all talking about the meanings and things, what role do you see monsters as playing in society and culture? I mean, what meaning do you find in them?
I think that they display a diversity of meanings, and I would actually use just a couple of different, specific historical examples. If you look at, the Puritan settlements in the 17th century, you know, we tend to think about the Puritans as being obsessed with witches, and of course they were, but they were fascinated with all sorts of monsters, including sea serpents. And so I talk about in the book, for example, there's this alleged sea serpent sighting in 1638 in just off the coast of Massachusetts, and the Puritan layman, he's not a clergyman, he's like a merchant or something. He essentially says, you know, I've seen this terrible creature rising out of the sea. It must have been a manifestation of the old serpent from the Garden of Eden. It must have been Satan himself, essentially.
I see.
Now, in the same part of the world, literally the same part of the world, in the early 19th century, I talk about a sea serpent sighting. Actually a lot more people claiming that they saw this thing, off of Gloucester Harbor. Fishermen actually get in boats and go out and chase it and try to catch it. And, there's not a discussion about, demonology or matters diabolical. They're talking in sort of semi-pseudo-scientific terms about what they're seeing. And they're actually even kind of trying to pull it into a political discourse, in the sense of using it as a political symbol for this or that. Didn't come across anybody, you know, these kind of, you know, ancestors of the breath of the posterity of the Puritans saying, hey, you know, we've seen the devil. Even when describing monsters that seem remarkably similar in different periods,
attitudes, really ideological attitudes about religion, politics, often gender and sexuality as well, inform what people think they're seeing and the meaning that they attribute to it.
Okay, I've got a question, and I don't want it to sound like an attack, because most of our questions are going to be about monsters. Okay. This one's about your book itself, though. And your book seems to fall into like this gray area between historical narrative and sociological commentary. And most of my experience with history books is they don't opine so much, so at least not directly. But you talk extensively about things about like the impact of slavery on the psyche of America, the role of monsters in pop culture. So how do you justify that the tone that you take, which seems to be like a tone of certitude about the meaning of these things, in matters that are pretty much subjective?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that they're entirely subjective in the sense that, I'm writing often less about, I'm certainly not sort of psychoanalyzing different eras in American culture. I'm trying to use primary sources, listening to kind of the sources themselves, and hear what people are saying about what these ideas, symbols, etc., mean to them. I think that historians do reach conclusions, and I think that that's a little bit different from, obviously kind of dogmatic assertion. When you have primary sources where, you have newspaper accounts of slave rebellions being described with the symbolism of Frankenstein's monster, then part of what you sort of have to do is figure out what's going on with that. Why is that kind of comparison being made? What kind of cultural work does that do for the people who are making the comparison? How do we understand their particular moment better, because of that?
Well, so let me follow up on that
please do.
Obviously the role of literature has always been one where people can present monsters or any kind of fictional context as a metaphor for real-world issues. But it seems like you're arguing that the monsters of American culture themselves are sort of like being produced in, a folkloric sense to sort of represent the same kind of thing without the narrative structure to go with it. Is that accurate?
I think that's close. Early on in the book, I say that I make it really clear that I'm uncomfortable with the idea of the monster as a metaphor. The monster as a reflection of anxieties, psychological states, that kind of thing. I really try to argue that, narratives of horror are interstitially related to the kinds of historical events that I'm interested in. And this in a way is not a terribly unusual argument. It's a little bit like talking about the role of race in American history. Race is not constituted by biology. There are biological there's biological connections. But it's largely a social construction. And yet, we talk about it, we've always talked about it as if it is something that is real, that has informed, the way that our social relationships have been arranged, that has had real world effects in terms of law. I think that's part of what part of it is. I'm kind of fighting against a monster literature. There is actually a pretty big monster literature out there, and a lot of it takes what I consider a highly, highly psychological interpretation of what the monster means. Lots and lots of books that essentially say monsters are anxieties, reflect anxieties about this and that. I think that they are historical narratives that are bound up in the way that American history has played itself out. So that's part of what I mean when I say earlier in the book that, I'm gonna take my monsters seriously. And even go so far as to say that I believe in monsters.
Okay. I was gonna say, I think that's a fair framework and a fair framing position, I should say. the reason I ask is because I want to give our listeners a context, because most of the time when we talk, we're talking about hard sciences and hard
right.
history, and your book is a very different book than one we've ever talked about before, yet the subject matter is completely the kind of thing that our listeners are going to enjoy. So that's all. And also, I want to say that I think that a lot of the commentary you made about the racial subtext of monsters in American culture are interesting, because it reminded me of something I'd kind of forgotten about, which is the sort of inherent racism in creationism. The very idea about
right.
the idea of there being individual races, which I think science has demonstrated
right.
is a social construct, not a scientific
right.
one.
Right. And actually that comes up in the book in a discussion of Scopes, which, you know, I call the Scopes monster trial, in the sense that there's a lot of dialogue about monstrosity going on around that discussion. I actually quote in it an Atlanta newspaper editorial where, you know, essentially says that, you know, if evolution is true, then A, we're descended from monsters. B, this totally undercuts white supremacy. We're much more closely related to African Americans than we actually want to be. So, all, you know, those issues of race and science, particularly in the late 19th, early 20th century, I think are kind of at the forefront of American monster culture and monster discussions.
Well, I think that a lot of our listeners would tend to think of monsters as being non-human cryptids of some kind, so as a salient form. So what are some of the other kinds of monsters as you see them?
Well, you know, I explore sort of the cryptid phenomenon, certainly, you know, and even sort of the whole, this, you know, this whole notion of undiscovered animals and where that comes from. You also, though, have to deal, with, you know, monsters that are seen as having a supernatural, even a diabolical origin. And so that's actually why religion plays, a pretty significant role in the book. So many monsters, the vampire in particular, are seen as having some kind of, you know, some kind of demonic origin. I do think it's interesting, though, that, a lot of the creatures that today might be thought of as cryptids, giant fish, wild men, undiscovered races, sea serpents that I mentioned before, at earlier times, there's sort of this non-scientific, pre-scientific discourse that surrounds them. Then at a certain point, at least in the minds of some, they get pulled into discussions about science. And I think actually among people, sort of the cryptid slash Freudian community today, my observation has been that still remains sort of a split. There's sort of this side that says, you know, Bigfoot, Sasquatch is this interesting animal. These other folks that say, you know, we're as interested in UFOs as we are in Bigfoot, and Bigfoot is this part of this mythological race that has this mythological origin. So all of that actually informed a lot of what I had to say about how monsters have become a way in different periods in American history to talk about the nature of science and to talk about what counts as science. I do make the point in the book that discussions actually about the sea serpent in the 19th century seem to have played a pretty significant role in the professionalization of science, and discussions about the nature of evidence and what counts as evidence and doesn't count as evidence.
Presumably these aren't the kinds of monsters that you believe in, the little green men and the sea serpents.
Well, you know, I mean, and I'm actually careful in the book. I make clear that, you know, I'm not a Freudian. I'm not sort of a poor man's Fox Mulder. I don't believe in the sense that, you know, that particular, those communities, I should say, would assert their belief. I mean, I believe that they are related to the structures of American society, and so therefore, they're more important than just, they can't simply be explained away as psychological states or what some people occasionally claim that they see. That's kind of my argument for why these narratives, why these creatures ought to be taken more seriously.
It seems like when I was reading your book, one of the themes that comes up over and over again, not just in your book, but in the subject of monsters in general, is the idea of xenophobia, you know, the fear of others, of outsiders, of sure. monsters, things that are sort of beyond ourselves and whatever else. Do you see horror as inherently about, you know, us about them, you know, us versus them, a sort of fear of otherness? Do you think that that's inherent in the characteristics of monsters?
Well, I think I would separate monster traditions from horror traditions. I think that in the monster tradition, that is one inherent strain. And in fact, going all the way back to the Middle Ages, back before, early American settlement, I think that you can see that, monsters as a way to talk about parts of the world and the peoples who live there that are not understood. I make a big point in the book of describing how essentially the first French and Spanish explorers, eventually the English explorers that come to the New World, that they come expecting to find monstrous races because their mythology had told them that's what they would find. And so there's almost this sort of there's this cultural preparation that goes on before they encounter Native Americans, and indeed even earlier in the mid-15th century, before they encountered Africans. And so they attribute a lot of the monstrous characteristics they expected to find to those peoples.
So are you saying that it's basically a self-fulfilling prophecy where if you're expecting to find monsters, then, you know, you'll find them where you look for them?
Well, you know, just theoretically, I'm sort of a big believer in Karl Popper's argument about those kinds of things, that, you know, we sort of see what we plan to see. Our theory guides what we're able to observe.
Absolutely.
Which actually I think goes a long way to essentially explaining why at different moments, you know, to go back to the sea serpent, you see sort of hundreds of people, seeing these kinds of creatures. So I would agree with that.
I'm also a fan of Popper's delicious stuffed peppers. Have you tried those? They are really
Yeah, most people didn't really realize that he had sort of a side avocation there. But yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, let me just do a quick follow up on that. I mean, you made an interesting distinction between monsters and horror, which I think
right.
obviously monsters are part of the context of horror,
yeah.
and there's horror that does not necessarily involve monsters. But in this xenophobia, which is inherent, I think in monsters, as you point out, and also generally in horror, I think in many cases, do you see the xenophobia as being cathartic? That is giving release to social anxieties so we don't enact them, and, you know, saying, okay, well, because we're dealing with monsters in this literary context or in this film, then we're sort of, that's our release. Or do you see them as provocational? You know, that we're having these monsters in our culture, in our memes, in our literature, and it's inspiring us to go out and act on that.
I actually think that goes back to the distinction that I would draw between sort of beliefs about monsters and the horror tradition, and sort of monster culture and the horror tradition. In that, I think that the monster tradition, which is in a way sort of larger than the horror tradition, includes things like folklore, also includes things like thinking of the monster not as something horrifying, but rather as something revelatory.
Mm-hmm.
Some back to kind of the original meaning of the monster as kind of an omen or a portent. Very frequently, the monster stories are simply about the other, and in one way or the other, in a positive or a negative way. And I think that that tradition does tend to be a provocative, a sort of encouragement. Not a catharsis, because I think the catharsis often comes in the violence that is done to specific groups and specific people, you know, being driven by the monster tradition. The horror tradition, on the other hand, is much more complicated. So it tends to involve the monster, but it's almost sort of bigger than the monster. The horror tradition is often as sort of subversive and undermining our, particularly in literature and film, undermining our understanding of what the monster means, calling into question whether or not, you know, the monsters are us, or whether the monster is actually out there. You actually see this a lot in the zombie, narratives, where the story tends to be, you know, sort of starts out, the monsters are the zombies. The real message is that the monsters are us, the things that we do to one another in these kind of post-apocalyptic situations that are imagined. That's kind of the real horror.
That's interesting because it reminds me of the sort of, in the real world, the transcendental quality that people report anecdotally when they experience a monstrous or horrific supernatural type event, or even a Bigfoot sighting, right? If you listen to people who've had Bigfoot sightings, it's almost a religious experience. Like they give testimony like the way people give testimony in the Baptist church, you know?
It's absolutely.
It's very interesting.
I think it's an important point because, you know, of course, I got really interested in when we think about monsters in the 40s and 50s, the 1940s and 50s, I mean, we tend to think of the movies. I mean, the alien invasion narratives, but as, you know, as you guys certainly know, I mean, that's also kind of ground zero for, you know, the first alleged sightings of flying saucers, the kind of contactee, movement, and all of that almost was being placed in highly, highly religious terms. And in fact, you have religious movements, sort of messianic memoirs being produced, out of that.
Oh, for sure. Adamski's Space Brothers, exactly.
Space Brothers contacted me to spread a message of peace, that kind of thing.
And that's still part of it. I mean, there is a sort of, in the contactee, phenomena. There's sort of a fearful, I don't know what's going on factor, but there's the other side of it. I would say the non-anal penetration side would be the side that says I was contacted by aliens and they have a message that we need to save the planet and that we're part of a galactic civilization and, you know, we can do this, that, you know, we can overcome. Never really any instructions, but that sort of message of we can. They're space Obamas. I don't.
Right. Yeah, they.
We can save the human race and put things in your butt.
They could do both, but usually it's one or the other, right?
it does tend to be one or the other, and I actually talk about both. There's a section in the book called Getting Probed, which, you know, it's a beautiful image to
use. A thoughtful
use analysis.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. I examined that, it's very fascinating that you have these kind of public discussions about sex with aliens sort of right on the verge of the sexual revolution. And people beginning to feel like they can talk about things in this, this contactee literature. That it's almost like, you know, it's off the cultural radar in any other sort of context. That's definitely part of it too. But in terms of religion and sort of the flying saucer phenomenon, one of the things that interests me is that even evangelical religion gets in on the act. I quote Billy Graham actually in the book. His own interest in flying saucers and his effort to kind of take those narratives and place them in an evangelical narrative, say that, you know, they're angels, they're evidence of spiritual warfare. People really are seeing these things, and these are signs of the last days and that kind of thing. So I actually think it's kind of more evidence of this kind of monster as meaning machine. You know, it's hard to pin them down because they're producing so many different meanings for so many different types of people.
Well, it's time to put on the Barry White and earn our PG-13 for this episode. Let's talk about sex. Okay.
Let's talk about sex. This is a book that's slam full of sex, right? I don't really think you can talk monsters without talking sex.
Right. So you go back to one of my favorite, which is the colonial witches, and then you move on to sort of the racist, monstrous pontifications about sex practices in Africa, satanic cults,
right.
Alien abductions. So everybody seems to think that monsters are getting the best, most interesting and vigorous sexual encounters. Why do you think that is?
you've asked me a question I've never been asked before.
Yay!
So that's really good.
That's what we do. Welcome to Monster Talk.
This is sort of the why are monsters good in bed portion of the program, I guess. Well, you know, I think that in part, because, and I think this goes back to our discussion about the monster tradition, one of the ways that monsters have been identified, even in non-American context, is as creatures of excess, creatures that are literally too much in some way, too big, creature with a thousand eyes, appetites are extreme. And so, you know, I think it's very easy to see how monster folklore, given that monster folklore, could get hardwired with sexual folklore. And that's actually a lot of what's dealt with. I talk about in the book, you know, for the early settlers, in America, particularly those who are first engaging in the slave trade, the sort of sexual folklore about Africa, and African men, and this racist, equation that is drawn between African men and monstrous apes, which unfortunately in the American monster tradition is an idea that, you know, continues to pop up. I mean, you know, popped up in the 20th century in many ways. I mean, it was a way to talk about, an extreme kind of experience. I do wonder if at some cultural moments, particularly more repressive cultural moments, it's sort of like, the literature and the folklore and the fictions of the fantastic are kind of the arena where it's okay to talk about those kinds of things. And so I think that actually may account, as I alluded to before, to this kind of, you know, the sexual experiences of contactees, in the 50s and in the 60s. And then of course, you know, more recently, I mean, vampires are obviously all about sex. I mean, they really can't be understood, despite what Stephanie Meyer says, they really can't be understood without that kind of, that context.
Sorry, I was going to say, who said the famous zipperless fuck? I can't remember. Anyway, I'll look it up later.
It's an Erica Jong, I think.
Yeah.
You talk about sexy monsters as well, and what were you referring to by that term?
Well, both our tendency to have a attraction and a kind of simultaneously repulsion to the monster, which I think is a cultural phenomenon that I would argue is especially strong in the United States. The reason being that, you know, America has, this ideology I talk about in the book, this idea of American exceptionalism, this notion of, American innocence, American purity. And, I think that monsters have frequently functioned as this dark place that we go, where we test the waters in terms of, you know, what does innocence endangered look like? What about, particular historical moments when people are especially worried about what that looks like? And one example that I would give, I think a kind of a preeminent sexy monster in American history is, Bela Lugosi's Dracula. And, it's a little hard to understand today, I guess, that, you know, Bela Lugosi, you know, opera outfit, whole nine yards, he was a real live sex symbol in the 1930s. Briefly married to Clara Bow, the it girl, Clara Bow. You know, just was causing fumes and flutters, you know, all among the female and certainly part of the male population as well during that period. This is the same period where there's an awful lot of anxiety about immigrants, particularly Eastern European immigrants. There's a completely irrational urban legend slash moral panic going on about, well, it's the white slavery panic, it's referred to. This fear that, like, innocent young girls from, you know, from the Midwest are going to places like Chicago and, oh my God, they're meeting up with these Slavs and these Jews and they're turning them into prostitutes, they're seducing them and turning them into prostitutes. And yet, you know, 1931, America's most popular monster is essentially an Eastern European immigrant who uses the powers of seduction in an obviously sexual kind of way.
Wait, are you talking about the dangers of white slavery? Wait. I'm horrible.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. So yeah, you know, I think that we tend to have just as a culture. I mean, the how individuals, you know, react to this is a different question, but as a culture there's kind of this attraction and repulsion to the idea of the monstrous, an erotic attraction and repulsion.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Well, let me ask about, so, you know, you talk about the moral panics and stuff. What do you think about the moral panic surrounding not only horror films but also the efforts to censor horror film and literature? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I think that's fascinating in part because horror films really do tend to be our cultural nightmares. I mean, that's how Wes Craven has essentially described them, somebody who obviously knows an awful lot about nightmares. And he, you know, I think he's right about that in the sense that they do become a way to dialogue about, sort of dialogue in public about the issues like violence, the relationship between violence and gender and sexuality, the places where our personal and cultural boundaries are. And my experience just in studying about moral panics of all kinds, because I've looked very closely with this in an earlier book about, sort of the concept of Satan in America. And my experience has been, that most of those forces, groups, lobby groups of different kinds that want to censor and push that kind of stuff away. I mean, they're less concerned about the monsters. I think they're even less concerned about the gore and the blood. They may even be less concerned about the nudity and the sexuality than they are just these bigger questions being asked in public and being represented in public. I think horror movies in particular just really tend to be very subversive. They tend to have subversive political messages, in one way or another. And I think that's often what's behind this ick. I can't believe we've got, you know, horror movies showing in our community. Quick personal story. I've actually come across this in reactions to my book. When I was doing the kind of the regional part of the book tour last year, when the book first came out, there was actually a tiny bookstore in a tiny southern town who, because the bookstore was so small, they had to have kind of a partnership with a local public library in order to bring me in, just because they didn't actually have any space to put people. I mean, there's this little hole-in-the-wall bookstore. And so that was all set, and about a week before I was supposed to, that was sort of going to be one of my upcoming stops, the public library, this small southern town, pulled out. And the reason that they gave was that, and I quote, the book is filled with bad language, which is interesting, and ideas that we would rather not have to deal with.
Wow. Suddenly we're in the 1700s. What the hell?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And which I took to mean ideas that we'd rather not have discussed, and then have patrons say, you know, I can't believe that, you know, you brought this person in and that this was talked about. So, you know, I don't think because the word fuck is in the book a couple of times, that was the reason. I think it was more sort of the second part of that concern. Like, let's not talk about race. Let's not talk about gender. Let's talk about sexuality.
Let's thank the South for keeping the sin and censorship, right?
Exactly. And I think that could conceivably happen in other parts of the country as well. I mean, that may be more of a rural urban kind of thing.
Oh, but, yeah. Yeah. I mean, every state has a South, right?
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, the Pennsylvania phenomenon. Right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. No, I just as another aside, I drove through Pennsylvania one time. We stopped a couple places, very rural, and it's like, really? Wow. These people are just like a lot of where I grew up in Georgia. So that's kind of funny because I usually think of Pennsylvania as being a very urban,
sure,
sort of place. And it's not. I mean, it's just all over the place.
America's, South Ohio. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So you talked about the movie Freaks being controversial. Yet at the same time, the film was suffering from that sort of issue in the box office. The freak shows in the 10 and 1 were still a popular part of American culture. And I know that I read The Monster Show by David Scull, and he talked about that as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, great book.
Yeah, really? Yeah, it's very enjoyable. So, but what's your take on that sort of dichotomy between the American public wanting to see real freaks, yet rejecting the film?
Yeah, and you know, that's actually sort of where I begin the book, and sort of thinking about cultural reactions to the monster, and I think it does go back to this kind of subversive element that often shows up in the horror tradition. I think it may even illustrate kind of what I was trying to say earlier about differences between the monster tradition and the horror tradition. In that, you know, on the one hand, I think that to go to a freak show, as millions and millions of Americans still were in the early 30s and had been really since the 1840s and 50s, was to see the monster, quote unquote, as an object, to view them, to see these people, to either laugh, be horrified, be fascinated, be repulsed, confirm one's own sense of normalcy, which has often been a big part of what the freak show is all about. There's actually a whole discussion about the popularity of freak shows in immigrant communities, because in immigrant communities you have groups of people who are themselves being treated as outsiders, but here they get the opportunity to attend the spectacle where they can sort of see these real outsiders, and sort of say, okay, well, I'm actually pretty normal, in comparison, you know, to the alligator man and, the world's smallest woman and that kind of thing. So, why then, are people repulsed in the sense of they don't even want to see it? They walk out of the theater, you know, MGM has to essentially sell the film away within a year or two with the movie Freaks. And I think that's because Freaks subverted that whole tradition of let's objectify the strange and the abnormal. It's the normals who are the bad guys, who are the villains in Freaks. The freaks themselves, despite sort of the extreme behavior and even kind of this murder, at the end, they are presented as, the people, and that's important, the people who have our sympathy. And they look at us. And that's actually a significant part of that film. The film itself, even the way that Todd Browning, who also did Dracula, by the way, even the way that it is shot, they often look at the camera and thus look at the audience. And I mentioned in the book that I read a number of memoirs of people who had been involved in the sideshow tradition. And, one of the themes that kind of kept popping up is that they would say, you know, sometimes, although I was often discouraged from doing this, by the owner of the circus or the carnival, I would make a point with certain audiences to make eye contact with them, to force them to recognize that I'm looking at them as much, if not more, than they are looking at me. And they often, you know, write about how, you know, just delighted at sort of how uncomfortable, they are and often will kind of go away. So, it was, I like that film, in part because I do think it's one of these horror tradition films that subvert our understanding of what normalcy is and what the monster is and where we draw those kinds of boundaries.
I think it's a kind of a pity that Browning didn't get to see any of the acceptance that came later.
Oh gosh, I know.
Yeah. So
because you know he died like literally right before that film was kind of reborn on the art house circuit. And
yeah, it makes me
Diane Arbus got interested, and yeah.
Right. I've been curious about that. Is that a product of he died and people went back to review his oeuvre, or is it that it was just a coincidence and he just missed it? You know what I mean? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, it seems like it's a little bit of both. I mean, '60s counterculture and sort of fascination with, you know, the bizarre and the different had something to do with it, I think. I mean, the film had actually been being shown. I mean, after 1932, it just kind of went underground. I mean, it was showing in kind of the, well, not grindhouse theaters, but kind of the precursor of grindhouse theaters. The kind of theaters that showed health movies, quote unquote, in the 1940s.
Volleyball is better naked. I think we all know that.
And, although, you know, during that period, the movie was also changed in some ways. Some of the title, there were new title cards put in that actually changed its message a little bit, that, you know, used terms like, you know, malformed creations, misfits of nature, capital N, that kind of thing. It's almost like even sort of the underground film crowd was a little uncomfortable with Browning's original vision.
I mean, we could probably talk for a full hour about Freaks. That's a great. I mean, the fact that the so called misfits also were an interracial group. They had everybody seemed to be treated equally, right?
And sort of this alternative community.
Yeah, it really is, and it probably mirrors to some extent, I guess, the actual sort of community those people lived in, and I love the performances of Johnny Eck, and I can't remember the name of the human worm, but those guys were so talented anyway, right?
Absolutely.
And then they got to show that on film for people who might never see them except in the context of the Freak Show. Anyway, I love the film. Anyway, so I'll put a link to that in our show notes too, so if people to find it.
Yeah, absolutely. And people ought to read as much as they can about the Hilton sisters, too, not to be confused with the more recent Hilton sisters, but the conjoined twins who are such a famous part of Freaks. They had a long career before and after the film. And speaking of kind of a sexual fascination with the monstrosity, that seems to have been a big part of their appeal in Depression-era America, because there's a lot of discussion about the number of boyfriends that they had, that they were married at a couple of different times. Imagination's running wild, I guess, is the point.
But what's your take on the appeal or social effects of films that, like the Saw series of the Human Centipede or the second sequence, the torture porn genre that's emerged in the last decade or so? What's your take? I mean, obviously, there's always been visceral, you know, nasty horror films going back to Cannibal Holocaust and Last House on the Left and things like that. But it seems like in the past, you know, 5, 6, 8 years or so, there's been a real development of that whole really particularly violent, gory, often sexual genre. And of course, there's been concern about, you know, it's yet another, you know, America's going to hell in a handbasket. Did you see Saw 4?
Right.
Do you think there's any validity to that? What's your take on the emergence of that as a subgenre of the horror?
Well, part of what's interesting about those kinds of films to me, Saw, Hostel, but then also these more extreme kinds of things, like not just the two Human Centipede films, but also this it's called a Serbian film. They really the effect is obviously or the effort is obviously to create as much shock, distaste, disgust, literal nausea as possible. I'm glad that you pointed out that these films have always been around in a certain sense. I mentioned the Grindhouse circuit, and you know, there was essentially a rape torture genre during the 1950s and 60s that played in those theaters. They actually called them the roughies, which essentially just featured rough sex, almost all of it directed against women. What I think is different is obviously this has become much more mainstream. I mean, Hostel was very much a mainstream film. It's also been, I mean, I guess this has been true of the, you mentioned Cannibal Holocaust and, you know, you could also think about some of the Fulci, films, the Italian zombie films that just were, you know, gore just, you know, everywhere, you know, unbelievable. And you know, I would just note that, films like Hostel and Saw pull, these stories, Human Centipede 2, completely out of any kind of supernatural context. They make the torture and the horror parts of these secret underground worlds, these almost kind of institutional worlds of terror. I mean, that certainly is what's going on in Hostel. There's kind of this secret network of people. And to a lesser degree, you could see Saw in that way too, just because, I mean, it's not, you know, the Ripper in the night with a knife. I mean, it's a much more complex, kind of arrangement in terms of, you know, ways to cause people to suffer. And so, you know, what I would say about that is, you know, I think it's almost kind of this changing sense of the impersonality of evil. I do think that it's a discourse about evil in the age of increased fears of terrorism and ethical questions about how to respond to that. I mean, lots of people have said, hey, you know, and I've said it a million times, that, you know, hey, we should pay attention to the fact that films like this are becoming popular, you know, right at the moment that we're having a national discourse about the ethics of torture. And that's one side of it. The other side of it, though, especially if you think about Hostel, is that, you know, you have this kind of system of evil, this evil network. Not only do the characters attempt and largely successfully, you know, escape from it, they also strike back against it. I mean, there's kind of this vengeance narrative, going on. Torture going on sort of from both sides. Those being tortured have to become savage, have to become something other than what they are, in order to be able to deal with this and respond to this.
Again, that's of course nothing new. I mean, you look back at some of the early films like, you know, I Spit on Your Grave, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Hills Have Eyes. You have these where, particularly with the I Spit on Your Grave, you have this obviously this this reversal, you know, where you have the abusers being abused in the end and this whole revenge fantasy. But for example, with The Hills Have Eyes, again, this is not just one psycho murder or whatever else. This is a, this is an underground, hidden sort of cultural society, you know, group of people who are doing these things. And so, but it, it's interesting what you're talking about, the discussion regarding torture porn following 9/11, because I actually wrote something about that and was interesting. It was interesting seeing that where, you know, immediately after 9/11 attacks, there were this discussion of how society is becoming more civilized and everyone's being nicer to each other. And oh my God, you know, we'll never have comedy again. And there will never be another horror film made because Americans are saturated with horror and we all want peace and happiness and Doris Day films. And of course that lasted approximately 3 weeks. And then almost immediately you had these sorts of films coming out.
Right. No, yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, in thinking about Hills Have Eyes and others, I would also, you know, throw in Last House on the Left, with that too. I think that fits in with that. Part of this may be something also that's just kind of hardwired into, the way Americans have thought about horror since the frontier period, because, you know, you could make the argument that these are new captivity narratives. The captivity narratives your audience may know was this really popular literary genre, going back to the Puritan period. It was essentially all about, savage Indians, quote unquote, you know, taking often Puritan women captive, always with the suggestion that there were, you know, weird kinds of torture and strange kinds of sexual things going on. And then often ending with, you know, the quote unquote redemption of the captive, that sometimes involved her simply getting away from her persecutors, sometimes involved, you know, Puritan men showing up with their blunderbusses and, you know, just wiping out the whole Indian village. And so, you know, that some of these films probably have something to do with, America's historical consciousness of the frontier and lines between savagery and civilization and those kinds of issues, which are, you know, pretty deeply embedded in cultural memory.
So you've been talking a lot about changing attitudes and fears, but at the same time, how a lot of things tend to stay the same. So I'm wondering, how have American monsters changed over time? Did the same things scare people today that scared them 100 or 200 years ago?
You know, they don't. And I actually started thinking about this project in part because, you know, as much as I love the Universal Studios monster tradition, Frankenstein, The Bride, The Wolfman, Creature from the Black Lagoon, et cetera, you know, people just don't find that scary anymore. There's, you know, nobody, essentially, after the age of three, that finds the Universal Studios monster tradition particularly frightening. People in the 1930s, they did. I mean, it was scary. And one answer to that, one explanation for that has always been, well, you know, people, times were simpler, back then. And, you know, maybe they just weren't as sophisticated. You know, times back then were as complicated as they get. I mean, times back then was the Great Depression and, the lynching in America and the rise of fascism overseas. And so, you know, it's not that, you know, they were somehow sort of more innocent. So, you know, I started sort of asking myself, well, you know, is it maybe something about what we're dealing with, what American culture is dealing with in particular kinds of eras that makes these things, especially frightening? And so to use my example from, you know, Universal Studios, I mean, you've already talked about how Dracula may have kind of fed into some of that and gotten connected to other kinds of cultural narratives. But Frankenstein as well, I mean, this is a period where American attitudes towards science and race is changing. I talk about in the book kind of the tradition of racist science, which often included notions about criminal brains, fiends that could not help themselves, the idea that African American men were particularly dangerous for that reason because they were sort of hardwired toward violence. And here you have in Frankenstein, here you've got a monster that whose brain is criminal, and who is a product of science, and also sort of unable to control his violence, which now, you know, I mean, one of the things I've thought about that as well is that, you know, now we tend to look at the Frankenstein story and we have a lot of sympathy for the monster. And we talk about the angry villagers with, you know, with their torches. That's the group we're not sympathetic to. I don't think that was the case, in the 1930s. Whatever the intention of the filmmakers, I think that most audiences saw this fiendish, violent monster, and it reminded them of experiences in their own communities where people like that had to be destroyed. I had kind of this moment of, I guess it was a moment of illumination, kind of a dark illumination, I guess, that in 1933, audiences that would have been watching Frankenstein and particularly watching the angry mob chasing Frankenstein to the windmill, I mean, that's showing in theaters all over America. It's showing in theaters in the South and in the Midwest. And so it's very likely that, you know, there would have been people sitting in the audience in that film who at some point had taken part in a lynch mob, who had actually performed the kinds of actions that's being shown on the screen being done to the monster. So, you know, where's their sympathy in looking at that narrative?
So I'd never read contemporary reviews. What do you think they had I've been there. I've done that.
Well, you know, we don't have any Americans saying it. We've got some foreign reviewers saying it. I quoted, it may just be in a footnote, but from a British review of Frankenstein, where he says, you know, this will remind American audiences of nothing so much as a Georgia lynching. And I'm sure it did. But, you know, even though, you know, between about 1890 and about 1947, you've got 5,000 African American men lynched in the South and in other parts of the United States. It remained kind of this great unspoken underground world, despite the fact that you had people from all classes of society who were involved in them.
If I can, I'd like to just go back for a second to the social consequences of horror films, because I've always found that to be a fascinating,
sure, absolutely
fascinating subject. What do you think about the concern that horror films inspire copycat crimes and influence the public? As I'm sure you know, there's been many films that have been banned, particularly in Britain. I recall, Clockwork Orange was banned for many years, even though not strictly a horror film, certainly a violent film. What's your take on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, of course, you're referring to, I believe they call it the video nasty controversy in
yes,
in
the infamous video nasties, yes.
Yeah, and Clockwork was a part of that. I mean, I don't see an essential connection between anything that we read, watch, take in, and our behavior. I wrote about this more really in Satan in America than in Monsters, but you know, my general sense is that the desire to censor those kinds of images, it's not just a simplistic interpretation of the relationship between behavior and texts. It's actually a kind of a way to ignore and to sublimate what's really going on. So, for example, in the 1980s, you have all of this concern about everything from heavy metal music to role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons to horror films to these urban legends that were part of the satanic panic. Children are being picked up, abused, ritually abused by these underground satanic groups. And, you know, it's the very same era that America's inner cities are being absolutely ravaged by the crack epidemic when, you know, you have a war on drugs that is actually completely ignoring sort of the street level effects of this. When you do actually have millions of children in those communities and elsewhere who are suffering from malnutrition and all kinds of actual sorts of problems. So I think it's I think it's a kind of way to create a moral rhetoric that that ignores difficult choices. I mean, you know, it's really in any given community, it's relatively easy to censor a film. But to deal with more complex social problems, that's going to take a little bit more than, you know, getting a petition up and riling up the parent-teacher association and that kind of thing. So, I think it's often, I mean, I'm sort of a, I guess it's always bad when you attribute bad motives to, to people you disagree with, but
right.
it is a kind of subterfuge, I think, of dealing with real actual issues.
Right, and it's sort of, as you mentioned, it's sort of simplistic solutions. Like, well, the problem to violent crime in society is not to ban the Saw films. I mean, it's just there's just no connection there, and yet, you know, many people sort of, that's one of the first things they go to because it's an easy target, I think.
Right, and you sometimes also hear the language of, well, this is a part of the coarsening of culture. Culture becoming more crude, and I think that's problematic because there have always been, you know, quote unquote, crude and coarse and vulgar parts of societal experience, and film comes a way to explore that.
Yeah, even our birds are angry in American culture.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So,
so how do you think anti-monster agencies in American culture fared in the marketplace of the monster, like the church or science or military, the sort of things you might think would be the solution?
Yeah, I don't know that they're solution. They're solutions. I think that they are in some cases institutions that need monsters of one kind or another. And I think also that, you know, if you sort of trace the history of science in America and scientific institutions, the monster has actually been very important. I alluded to this in our discussion about the sea serpent, but, you know, in the early 19th century, you've got major scientific organizations in the young United States, who really bet their reputations on the existence of these creatures. In one case, the New England Linnaean Society in the 1820s, claiming that essentially they have the spawn of a sea serpent. They have a baby sea serpent, or at least its skin. And then, Louis Agassiz comes along and says, well, you know, actually, this is a fairly common New England water snake that has a skin condition of some kind. That's why it has these weird bumps. And so, you know, that particular scientific association collapses. It's gone. I mean, it never recovers from that. And that's actually an important moment because it's a moment when, when people like Charles Lyell, the geologist who himself believed in sea serpents for a while, started saying, you know, maybe eyewitness accounts don't really, maybe that's not what we mean by empirical evidence. Maybe empirical evidence is having something in a lab, you know, as opposed to someone who says they saw it. So, you know, I would say monsters have been sort of very important for science as well.
Well, Scott, a final question. We always like to ask our guests to tell us about their favorite monster. So what's your favorite monster?
Oh, absolutely. The Bride of Frankenstein. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, she's sort of this Art Deco masterpiece for one thing. I mean, just the look with the hair and everything. That's amazing. I mean, that's just sort of an amazing accomplishment of design. But, she's also, you know, she's also kind of America's first, she's one of America's more important, subversive monsters. It's very interesting that she's a female monster, and she's a female monster that refuses the designs of her creator. Her creator sort of made her to be a helpmate, to, you know, her male counterpart, and, which, you know, sounds familiar. But she essentially says no. In fact, she sort of screams no. So yeah, I love the Bride of Frankenstein. I think she's pretty cool. I'm actually wearing my Bride of Frankenstein t-shirt right now.
All right.
Did you watch Gods and Monsters, I assume?
I love Gods and Monsters. I actually love the novel, as well, Christopher Bram's, novel. And, I'm actually pretty excited. I'm actually supposed to meet Christopher Bram in a few days, the novelist behind that. And here in a couple of months, we're going to be on a panel together talking about Gods and Monsters, talking about sexuality and horror narratives and that kind of thing. So yeah, that's a very cool movie about the life of James Whale, and interesting period in Hollywood too.
It was, and it, he's a fascinating character himself. And I also thought that the film explores that really interesting idea of the sort of generative energy, but without the female, right? So
right, yeah, absolutely.
It's really interesting.
Yeah,
they're making
which is
life.
A big part of that film. Yeah,
yeah, but at the same time that they're making the woman, she's really only existing as a companion to the monster, not in any way as a mate who's going to be able to make new monsters. All the creation, all the generative process is held by men there. It's very, very,
right.
Very complicated ideas in that film.
It is, yeah. It absolutely is. And, another thing I actually like about the book and the film a lot, the book does this even more than the film, and there's a lot in the film, is that showing the connections between the experience of war and the experience of horror. Which, that's kind of David Scull's, influence. I mean, that's a pretty important idea, for him. And the film does make a lot of the fact that, you know, of course, James Whale is a World War I veteran, saw a friend and in fact his first lover die in the war. And then that moment, you know, where he sort of holds up the gas mask, in this kind of totemistic, you know, sort of way. It's kind of, you know, war as inspiration for horror narratives, which is a pretty important idea. David Scull is actually briefly in that movie.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's in it very briefly at the beginning. He actually is part of a film crew, and I believe he actually says action or something like that just as the film starts. So that's just pretty cool.
That's a cool bit of trivia.
Yeah.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us today for this interview.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. I mean, the questions have been great.
Monster Talk.
Thanks again for listening to Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Karen Stolzno, we interviewed Scott Poole about his new book, Monsters in America. A link to his book and other related materials are in the show notes. Thanks again to everyone who's contributed to our transcript project. That's coming along well. Your contributions, even little ones, are helping turn Monster Talk into a more easily locatable resource on the web. I'm working with our webmaster to put together a tribute page to all the listeners who've helped us. And remember, as we talked about at the top of the show, you can help us just by giving us a review on iTunes. It only takes a moment, and this is a great week to try that. Special thanks this week to Jonathan Ping, David Rodriguez, Hilton Cockcroft, and Ronald Knobloch. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. I'm pretty sure every time you read Skeptic, an angel gets its wings. Or something like that. At any rate, the ideas presented in Monster Talk are not necessarily the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
Sorry, you were cutting out there for me. I wasn't sure if you'd finished speaking or not.
Yeah, I was all done. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, when I run out of things to say, I say something about cultural memory.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.